Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining us today. We are excited about the announcements that we're making this afternoon. I am joined by Rod Beasley and Luke Krupp of Ricardo and Bob Reynolds of Downstream Alternatives. Ricardo has done the analysis that you now have, and we'll walk through it in a wee bit. As you know, the blend wall that the ethanol industry is facing is one of the industry's most critical challenges today. And the EPA has been evaluating a waiver request that the industry put in more than a year ago now. And indications are that the agency is contemplating granting a partial waiver because the data that they have before them is not suggesting that there are any issues, but they've been looking at just a select number of newer vehicles. We've been concerned about a partial waiver. We have very deep concerns for the confusion that it might create in the marketplace for consumers, certainly for gasoline marketers themselves as well. And we are concerned that, as a consequence, the market opportunities for ethanol resulting from a partial waiver would not really be what we need. That would be fine if there was indeed a justification for a bifurcated decision. But as we believe, if EPA were to grant E15 for 2001 or 2007 and newer vehicles, there's no reason to suggest that they shouldn't be granting that for older vehicles as well. That was our supposition, but we wanted to make sure that we were on solid technical ground, and so we contracted with Ricardo to do an independent analysis to evaluate what are the regulatory constraints that these vehicles are facing, what might be the materials compatibility, emissions, or drivability issues, and to provide us with some guidance. Quite frankly, there's probably no better firm that could do this than Ricardo. They are an internationally recognized automotive engineering firm. We think they've got unparalleled expertise in vehicle systems and controls and electronics and driveline and transmission systems and in powertrain technologies. They've got offices across the globe. They've got clients in the industry and in governments across the globe. And we felt that there was nobody better to do this analysis. I'm going to turn it over to them now, but the bottom line is, if the agency is going to allow E15 to be used because of their evaluation of a 2007 and newer or a 2001 and newer vehicle, that the change from E10 to E15 is just not significant enough not to allow that for older vehicles as well. And there's simply no need to issue only a partial waiver or a bifurcated waiver. But I'll turn it over to Luke Krupp now from Ricardo.
All right, thanks, Bob, and good afternoon, everybody. I am going to run through a quick presentation, which is really just an overview or synopsis of a much deeper study, obviously, that's been performed. I'll try to hit some of the high points here in the presentation. But I want to stress the fact that, as the title page indicates, this is a technical assessment of the use of E15, specifically in model year vehicles produced between 1994 and 2000. So it's a fairly focused study. We're not discussing here the distribution of fuels, the production of fuels. We're discussing here the use of this particular fuel blend in these vehicles. So, just to give you a little bit of background on Ricardo, Ricardo is a company that's been around in some form since 1910. It was formed by Sir Harry Ricardo back then over in the UK. Harry Ricardo is one of his probably best-known pieces of work is the development of the octane rating system, which we still use today, and which, you know, anytime you buy fuel and it says 87 or 89 or 93 or whatever at the pump, that's based on the octane rating system that Harry Ricardo helped develop. So our background, our tradition is in engines and engine development, and as Bob said, we're a much broader global company now. You can see all the various locations of engineering centers that we have around the world here on this page. So before we get into the results of the study, we just wanted to talk about what exactly is the E15 fuel waiver and state exactly what that is. So there's a waiver currently in front of the EPA listed here in some of the smaller print at the bottom of the page to consider the use of 15% fuel ethanol and 85% unleaded gasoline by volume in the motor vehicle fleet. As Bob alluded to a couple minutes ago, there's been some discussion about potential approvals at some bifurcated point, either in 2001 or 2007 model year vehicles. And of course, we're not going to focus on this through the presentation today, but that would obviously potentially limit the use or implementation of E15 into the overall market. I'm not going to go through all this fine print here, but in the middle of the paragraph, you can see a parenthetical statement which talks about the useful life of the motor vehicle or its engine, and the useful life of the vehicle is going to become an important point as we move through this discussion, so we want to keep that in mind. So what did we actually do in terms of our technical assessment? I've just got kind of the backbone here of what we did, some of the high level points of what we looked at. Of course, there's a lot of detail in the actual document, which goes through each of these thoroughly. But let me just say what we tried to do first of all was identify what types of fuel system hardware were out there and how it was changing throughout the 94 to 2000 mile year period. In a few slides, I'll discuss so what some of those changes were as we were moving through this period. It was a period of change in terms of regulation and legislation, and that drove changes in the hardware, and we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about what specifically some of those EPA regulations were, how they were adopted, and then what their rollout looked like. You may or may not know there's public data on EPA's website, which you can evaluate, which describes the tailpipe emission certification level of every vehicle that's been produced under EPA's authority, regulatory authority. And so we did go deeply through some of that data from some of the key vehicles from these model years, and we've got some results to discuss based on that. From our own internal experience, we went through after-treatment and vehicle calibration data. And then we really wanted to get into understanding the fuel a little bit better as well in terms of what characteristics E15 brings, again, as opposed to E10. Well, what we're discussing here is the move from E10 to E15 specifically. So that's a key point to understand, that almost all motor vehicle fuel in the U.S. today is E10. So based on those characteristics of the fuel, then we wanted to identify how this fuel may or may not degrade in fuel systems or components in vehicles, and what those mechanisms of degradation were, and whether they'd be the same, worse, or better on E15. And finally, an interesting part of the study, at least for me personally, was we actually procured some end-of-life parts from vehicles from this time period, and inspected those. And we've got a few example pictures at the back of this presentation, a much more comprehensive review of those parts in the full report. So I've been talking a lot about what were the key vehicles or the high volume vehicles. And the next couple slides are going to talk about how we kind of parsed down the current vehicle population in the U.S., light duty vehicle population, and try to get to the point where we could do an engineering analysis on certain models that were representative. But first, this slide talks specifically about the current light duty U.S. vehicle fleet. So that's passenger cars, automobiles we generally think of as cars, and light-duty trucks, so up to 8,500-pound GVW vehicles. And there's just under 250,000 of those in use today, according to EPA's MOVES model. Approximately 25% of that population, and that's shown in the light blue or leftmost columns in the chart, roughly 25% of those were produced between the 1994 and 2000 model year, and that's a population represented then about 62.8 million vehicles. So it's a significant population that needs to be well understood. The current assessment, which we feel is already comprehensive in its own right, being done by the U.S. DOE and other government and industry bodies, represents another 63%. So all in all, the light gray bars, which is the third bar over from the left on the, in the plots, represents roughly 88% of the vehicles that are in use today. So understanding the implications of E15 on that overall percentage would obviously go a long ways in terms of the actual usability of the fuel in the field. We broke down the sales numbers from the period, 94 to 2000, and it was obvious very quickly that six primary manufacturers were the biggest producers by far during this period. Those are listed at the top of the page here. This table is obviously fairly long, but it represents the top 25 platforms that were sold. And a platform, of course, could have many nameplates, as you can see in the vehicle model column. But the top 25 platforms with the top 10 shown in bold. So we then took this information and focused on these makes and models and these platforms to try to understand in a statistically significant way what the effects of E15 would be. So these vehicles were produced under various levels of emissions regulation in both tailpipe and evaporative emissions regulation. I think it's important to point out, just as we start this discussion on regulation rollout here, number one, almost all these vehicles were certified a 10-year or 100,000-mile useful life. And as you can see, since we're basically in the 2011 model year now, basically all these vehicles are out of compliance, even if they were barely driven. So even if they didn't meet the miles requirement, they are out of actual regulatory legislative control based on time. So as we talk about the specific rollout and the changes that that came on during this time, because these changes did affect the design of the vehicles, the materials used in the vehicles, I think it's important to understand that the real issue at hand here is whether these vehicles are going to experience an illumination of the malfunction indicator lamp or the mill light, the check engine light, some people call it, on the dash, or whether they're going to experience gross leaks. Those are the two consumer issues that we were really going to see and that we wanted to evaluate whether or not you were going to undergo. But as you look through the table here, the top table is the tailpipe emissions requirements, and you can see the Tier 1 emissions requirements were just rolling in at the beginning of this study period, which is one of the reasons we chose that year as the start point. There's a couple others as well, which we can discuss later. But you can see certification at Tier 1 was required 100% maximum there in the second row down by 1996. And then toward the end of the study period, some of the CARB Level 1 requirements, which are specifically to do with hydrocarbon emissions, were rolling out in the 99 and 2000 model years. And, of course, our emissions compliance requirements today in vehicles since 2004, which is when Tier 2 was rolled in, are orders of magnitude more difficult to achieve than these Tier 1 emissions requirements. So, but this was kind of the time period where we're moving from very lax emissions requirements to much more stringent and starting into the EPA tiered emissions classes, which we're still under today. And if you look at the bottom chart, this has to do with evaporative emissions and the rollout of what's called enhanced evaporative emissions requirements. Starting in the 96 model year and fully implemented by the 99 model year, this is a much more comprehensive understanding of what the overall vehicle puts out in terms of evaporative emissions. So when the vehicle is off, what it's emitting simply by sitting there. And you can see ORVR, the very bottom portion of that that table, which is onboard vapor recovery. Those systems were also implemented toward the end of the study period, and that has to do with capturing the vapor that is pushed out of the fuel tank when you fuel up at a fueling station. So I guess all that to say, really, a lot of hardware and calibration changes happening during this time period. So what's the overall end result of all that? On the next slide, I'll hit on two key points there, the tailpipe emissions and the evaporative emissions points. for tailpipe emissions, and again, a much more in-depth description of why we believe this is the case can be found in the report. But assuming the EMS, or engine management system, can maintain the stoichiometric air-fuel ratio in the engine, which we believe that it can, there really should be no change to the catalytic converter in terms of its ability to take engine out emissions and convert them into non-polluting species between E10 and E15. So that's kind of a big statement, obviously, with a lot of data and information behind it. We can either answer questions on that, or the report can more give you more detail. And then on evaporative emissions, there's really two constituents, vapor pressure and permeation emissions. In terms of vapor pressure, E15 has been shown through several comprehensive studies now to actually have lower vapor pressure than E10 does. In terms of permeation, there's really not a lot of data out there on E15. Some of the data that is out there indicates in some vehicles you may have more and some you may have less. In general, the permeation emissions are really not much different between E10 and E15. So that leads us into the fuel system components evaluation. And again, this is where the consumer may, or we thought may see some effects. So what we did is, from those top 10 platforms, which I identified a few minutes ago, we bought some end-of-life pieces, fuel systems, complete fuel systems out of vehicles. And this is one of them, shown here, 1997 Pontiac Grand Prix. Steel fuel tank. Now, most fuel tanks today, probably all fuel tanks today, are plastic with various liner materials to reduce evaporative emissions. This one obviously was not designed that way, so it's steel. I think the interesting thing really here when you look at this piece of equipment is inside the tank looks very, very good. There's really no issues at all with it. Outside the tank doesn't look very good. So you can see that the degradation of the tank material itself is really coming from the outside in due to outside forces, salt and moisture and temperature change, as opposed to inside-out corrosion, which would come from the fuel source. So, again, this vehicle, at least for this past several years, has been running E10, just because that's all that's available in the region where we are. And I think it's important anecdotally as well to just mention some of the fuel lines that were that we got off some of these vehicles as well. Very flaky on the outside, where again the degradation being from the outside in, and you could essentially take the fuel line and almost snap it with your hands. It was that thin, but the inside of the fuel line still looked fine. The flaking and the degradation was coming from the outside. So that's anecdotal evidence. We've got some harder evidence, some more engineering. Based evidence here coming up in a couple of slides. The next slide I wanted to show a little more standard case condition. This is from a 1998 Ford Taurus. Again, a steel fuel tank, but either because of location of the vehicle or where it spent part of its life or whatever, it's in much, much better repair. Again, the inside of the tank doesn't show any ill effects, but the outside of the tank looks much better than the other one. And then we're also showing on the upper right the fuel line bundle. This is the fuel lines that run from the fuel tank area of the vehicle up to the front into the engine bay. The lower left shows the fuel rail and fuel injectors, which obviously have a lot of rubber seals and plastic components. And then the lower right, the fuel filter. So another component that could be either plugged or have some kind of detrimental effect if corrosion was taking place inside the components. You can see inside these components that we've sectioned, really no issues at all in terms of fuel. So the key thing then is moving from E10 to E15 being such a small change in terms of actual fuel makeup, really these vehicles should have no issues with that. So before we go to the next page, I just want to mention what are the key degradation mechanisms of components that are in these fuel systems. First of all, for metals, the issue is corrosion. For plastics, the issue is hardening and embrittlement based on that hardening. And then for rubbers or elastomers, it's swelling and the potential failure of hoses, things that could be based on the swelling of the material from the fuel makeup. So what we did is put together a list of common fuel system materials from the period. listed any compatibility issues. We did include E0 on here just for reference, although the real comparison is E10 versus E15. And we indicated a directional change from E10 to E15. And you can see there's either none or very minor types of actual material issues that you're going to get. There's, again, a much more comprehensive discussion of this in Section 8 of the report that, you know, certainly would be, if you're interested in this portion of it, would be worth the read. But so I get overall conclusion then, the adoption of E15 is not going to adversely affect fuel system components in properly engineered vehicles or cause them to operate in a suboptimal manner as opposed to how they currently operate on E10. So there are, of course, vehicles out there that are either were designed or are being used in a non-traditional manner, and those may experience an issue, but for the vast majority of vehicles, based on the statistical sampling methods that we've gone through here, there's really not going to be any issue moving to E15 from an engineering analysis perspective.